Okay, so here we are at the final lecture of the conference. So we're going to give an application of homogeneity today, and so the goal, at least from my perspective, is to give you all some idea of how asterisk 269, that's the big blue book we passed around last time, works. Okay, so some idea. So just recall our homogeneity result. So we have some fixed alcove C in our apartment, and then we have this theorem that says if you restrict to the functions which are compactly supported on the Lie algebra and invariant with respect to the Lie algebra of the Ewell-Hoyer subgroup, those distributions which are compactly supported and invariant with respect to the adjoint action, then that's the same thing as looking at functions which the restriction to the functions which are compactly supported on the Lie algebra and invariant with respect to G sub C of linear combinations of nilpotent orbital integrals. And the second part of the statement was that there's a nice place to find a dual basis. So if T is a compactly supported invariant distribution on the Lie algebra, then the restriction to functions, the same space of functions, if T is 0, if and only if, and then eventually we decided that the statement should be that for all pairs F O bar sitting inside of our set ID mod equivalence relation. So what is this? So F is a facet in the apartment, and this is a distinguished nilpotent orbit in the Lie algebra associated to F, and then we had the usual equivalence relation on that set. So for all such things, we need that T of the characteristic function of the coset associated to the orbit O should be 0. And we need a Fourier transform someplace. Okay, so that's what we decided should be true, yeah, last time. And we even kind of proved that 2 implies 1. Proving that 2 is true, hopefully I've given you sufficient it's hard, let's just say that, okay? So I also have to post the following warning. Of course, this function here, so you take the care. Right, you take this orbit over the finite field, you inflate it, and then you take the characteristic function of the associated set. So this is not a compactly supported function on the Lie algebra invariant with respect to the Ewell-Hoyer Lie algebra. However, if you look at how it was constructed, it is in the sum over all alcoves C prime, and well, we don't actually know what the building is, but from previous lectures you have some idea of what it is. Those functions supported on the Lie algebra and invariant with respect to G C prime. Okay, but since all alcoves are conjugate to our basic alcove under the action of G on the building of G, and since our distribution T is G invariant, this shouldn't bother you too much, okay? Okay. So the first thing we need to discuss is the concept of stability. And in particular, what does it mean for a distribution to be stable? You know, if we just want to talk about invariant distributions, then it's completely clear what we mean, right? A distribution is invariant if it has the property that T of GF is equal to T of F for all G and G and for all F appropriate kind of function. But it's far less clear what it should mean to be stable. So as motivation for the definition, we consider a nice result of Harishchandra's. So definition, I guess this stands for annihilator. This is the set of functions, smooth, compactly supported on the Lie algebra, such that mu sub x of f is 0 for all regular semisimple x. Then you have the following theorem due to Harishchandra. So suppose that T is a distribution on the Lie algebra. Okay, not assumed to be invariant, just a distribution. Then we have that T is an invariant distribution on the Lie algebra if and only if the restriction to the space of functions Dn is 0. So in other words, the regular semisimple orbital integrals are dense in the invariant distributions on G with respect to the kind of the dumb topology. Okay, so by the end of this lecture, you'll be able to prove this because we're going to present the results of Altreger, which essentially uses the same proof. Wow. Yeah. So with that result and lots of work on your part. Okay, so that's our motivation. So now let's look at stable things. Stable. Okay, so definition. We'll define the stable annihilator, so STN. This will be the set of functions F locally constant, compactly supported on the Lie algebra, such that every stable orbital integral is 0. Okay, so what does this mean? So you just have to recall from, for example, Tom Hell's lectures that you know, when you take your group G, you look at the orbit of x over the algebraic closure, so this is some variety, then you intersect that back with the rational points of your Lie algebra, and this is a disjoint union of a finite number of rational orbits. And so SUX is just defined to be the sum of the orbital integrals x sub I, okay, and then, you know, with appropriate normalizations of measures. But if you're careful from the get-go, which we haven't been, but maybe in the when I write it up, then you don't have to add that sentence. And so then we remark that the annihilator, D annihilator, is contained in the stable annihilator. So how do we define the stable distributions? Well, we just kind of copy this theorem of Harishchandra, and we say that a distribution is stable if it dies on the stable annihilator. Okay? That's how you say that in simples. And of course, since the annihilator is in the stable annihilator, that means that this thing contains, or no, better be the other way, right? It's contained in the invariant distribution. So how about some examples of stable distributions? Well, for all regular semisimple elements x, it's certainly true that this guy is a stable distribution, okay? And it turns out that beyond that, you can't really say too much, okay? This guy is always stable, as is its Fourier transform. Okay, so these are two, all these guys belong here, as you can easily verify. So the problem is that essentially, what? Closed. The Fourier transform, yeah, this is a huge result of Walter-Pichet that the Fourier transform of a stable distribution is stable. Actually, he proved something even better than that. He proved that the fundamental lemma is true when you're considering when your endoscopic group is an inner form. The Lie algebra. Okay, so here's the big problem. No one understands. Well, okay. No one I know understands this thing. I mean, it has no intuitive. This is pretty easy to understand. But if someone gives you a distribution and says, is it stable? You just say, I have no idea, unless it's one of those three. Where? Yeah. So let's try. So the first approximation at understanding you could ask, well, what are the stable distributions supported on the nilpotent set? What is that? And why would you like to know that? Well, so remember from statement number one, right? Somehow the left-hand side of statement number one in the homogeneity theorem contains all the information that you want to know for the fundamental lemma, and it reduces, right? You have to consider all stable orbital integrals or all various combinations of orbital integrals in order to prove the fundamental lemma, and somehow this statement just reduces it to considering only nilpotent orbital integrals, which is a finite, well-understood set of things. So it'd be good to know what this was. What is it? And we're not going to tell you what it is, but I will say that Walter-Pichet has figured it out for all unramified classical groups. And it's also known for G2. Okay, what is it? Well, here's how you begin to answer that question. So you have the following results of Walter-Pichet. So suppose that you start with a distribution which is compactly supported and invariant. And then you choose a distribution D, which we'll write as a distribution D which is supported on the nilpotent set, so it can be written as a linear combination of nilpotent orbital integrals. So you choose that D so that, you know, they agree in statement number one, so that the restriction to the functions which are invariant with respect to GC of T is equal to the restriction to the same sorts of functions of D. So then he proves that if T is stable, then D is stable. So, two remarks. First, which I won't write down on the board. First, there's a version of this lemma that, you know, instead of stable, you might want to consider what should, you know, some combination that actually is a kappa orbital integral, then you get the same kind of thing, suitably interpreted. And the second comment is, why would we like to do this? Well, so what this does, it says that if you want to describe things that are stable on the right-hand side, then you should really look for an extremely nice basis for the left-hand side that you can really handle and figure out what kinds of things in there are stable. For every T, there will be a unique D such that this happens. Here's the proof. Oops. We want to keep. Excuse me? No, that's a bad erasing job. We need to show that for all f and d stable annihilator, we need to show that d of f is 0. Right? And that will mean that d is stable. So you notice that if f belongs to the stable annihilator, then f t squared also belongs to the stable annihilator. Where Omri, ft squared of x, is defined to be f of t squared x. Right, that's fairly clear because after all, the set of regular semi-simple elements is, you know, if you scale a regular semi-simple element, it's still regular semi-simple. Okay, so 0 is equal to T of F, because T is assumed, F of T squared, because T is a stable distribution to start. Sorry, I forgot to say something. So what do we do? So now fix F here, and choose T in K cross, but not in the units, such that f of t to the 2n is an element of the compactly supported functions on G, which are invariant with respect to GC. Okay? For all n greater than or equal to 1. We can do this, it's just a scaling problem. So then, you have 0 equals t of f sub t to the 2n, but f sub t to the 2n is in this space, therefore by number 1 we can write this as d of f sub t to the 2n, and so what is this? Well, this is the sum over the nilpotent orbits c sub O of T, mu sub O of F sub T to the 2n. Okay, but nilpotent orbits are homogeneous. So we can rewrite that as the sum from I equals 0 to some finite number of t to the minus I times n, the sum over the nilpotent orbits such as the dimension of O is I, C sub O of t, mu sub O of f. Right? Mu sub O of f sub t squared is t to the minus dimension of the orbit, mu sub O of f. Okay, and this is true for all n greater than or equal to 1. So this thing is 0 for all n greater than or equal to 1, and this number here is not 1. So that means that this must be 0. Which means that d is 0. D of f. So not only is the distribution d stable, but in fact each of its homogeneous pieces is stable. To have any hope of describing the stable distribution support on n, the thing to do is to find an excellent basis for the restriction to the functions which are invariant with respect to the Ewell-Hoary-Lie algebra and compactly supported. Find an excellent basis for the space. So what does that mean? So that means, i.e., of the form mu sub restriction to compactly supported functions on the Lie algebra invariant with respect to GC, mu sub x, mu sub xi, if you like, with the xi extremely manageable. Regular semi-simple element. Okay, so remember,
extremely manageable.
Nope, that's, so I'll tell you. So remember over here on this board, right here, really, these are the only three distributions that kinds of distributions we know are stable, okay? So instead of trying to concoct something, you know that this thing is a stable distribution, okay? So what you want to do is you want to find a basis for this thing of this form where you can easily toss these into stable combinations when they're supposed to be stable, and then you can put them into obviously non-stable combinations when you want to, okay? Now this sounds hard, but in fact, it is hard, but in fact, it's doable. Okay. So the first thing you have to do, I just erased the statement. Dang it. Is you want to replace this dual basis that you have with something different that you can manage. So from 2 of the homogeneity statement, we know that this set of functions forms a dual basis. And so the idea is find nice functions on LF. Remember, that's the Lie algebra of the reductive quotient sans serif G sub F that separate distinguished nilpotent orbits. So remember at the last lecture or two lectures ago, I don't remember, I said that we don't really have a very nice understanding of or description of the distinguished nilpotent orbit over a base field. But it turns out we have something that's probably even better. We have these functions. So here's the fact. This fact is due to mostly to Lustig. So there exist functions which are we call generalized, you know, I'm going to have to write that a lot, generalized Green's functions, okay? Such that, well, they span they span the function supported on the nilpotent elements in the Lie algebra of your finite field, which are invariant with respect to the adjoint action. And two, the cuspidal generalized Green's functions, cuspidal having the usual meaning, i.e. when you integrate against the nil radical, you get zero, or sum against the nil radical in this case, separate distinguished nilpotent orbits. Theta? There's no theta on the board. Okay, so this is just from the finite field, right? And this is just something that you have to believe. So do you believe? Good. So I'll give you an example. Yeah, sorry. So this is a nilpotent set, or nilpotent elements. Okay, the set of nilpotent elements in L. So here's an example. So if you take sans serif T, I guess, well, I don't know, it's not, well, whatever, okay? So suppose you have, if this guy is an F min isotropic torus, okay, so what does that mean? Min isotropic means that the F split part of this torus lies in the center of GF. Okay? Then the usual Green's function okay, which is Q sub T upper G sub F evaluated X. So whenever I have an element of the Lie algebra over the finite field, I always put a bar on it. That's zero if X is not an F and R T G F 1 X X otherwise. Okay, where this is the linguistic. Huh? Not, thank you. Yep. Where this is the linguistic character. So this is a cuspidal Green function. This is a generalized Green function, and it's cuspidal because T was chosen to be an isotropic. Unfortunately, I mean, we'd really be set in life if like we're always like, say, GLN, where all the cuspal green functions are this form. But unfortunately, they're not. And I'm just going to say a couple words about what happens when they're not. When they're not, what's about to happen becomes much more difficult. And the thing that you apparently have to use, based on Walsh-Rouget's work and my own work with Kajdan, is you have to use that famous paper of Kajdan and Lustig that was mentioned on the right board in Hill's talk. Well, it's hard. That's all I can say. Someday maybe it will be beautiful and easy, but not yet. So remember, what we're trying to do is find this excellent basis. So here we have, not quite yet. So one thing that makes you think that you have a hope of doing this is that you have the following fact. This is the result of Kajdan. And this proof of the Springer hypothesis. So on the no-put null elements of Lie F, you have the following equality. Q sub T GF is equal to minus 1 times the rank of G sub F times, I'll just write it down, the number of elements in the Lie algebra of T to the 1/2 divided by the number of elements in the torus times, okay, here's the thing that makes you think life might be okay, times the Fourier transform of the sum over, well, it's just the Fourier transform of the orbital integral, essentially. But okay, where xt is any element in the Lie algebra such that the centralizer in G sub f of xt is t. Okay? So this thing has an extremely nice property with respect to some regular semi-simple element over in the Lie algebra. So, correct. So now, given all that has happened before, it's not hard to believe that the following lemma is true. So, right, so this is just something you have to believe. Do you believe? Good. So for T in compactly supported invariant distribution, the restriction to compactly supported functions on G that are invariant with respect to GC of T is zero if and only if T of GF hat is zero for all pairs FG and IG mod equivalents. Okay, so there's a couple of new symbols on the board. So what is IG? IG, that's the set of pairs, F a facet, G a generalized green function. So cuspidal generalized green function on where? On LF. Okay, and then the equivalence relation is exactly the same equivalence relation before, as before, right? Because when you could line up those facets, you got an F isomorphism of the groups, which gave you an F isomorphism of the Lie algebra, which meant you can identify just about any object between one and the other, and so you want to identify functions. So that's what you do. And then G sub F, so this gives you G sub F, which is just the inflation G to a function. It'll live in, it'll be supported on GF and invariant with respect to GF plus. And we always think of this as being in CC infinity of G. Okay, so you should right? We've already shown essentially that part two says, in fact, that if you, instead of this, you ran over the distinguished nilpotent orbits, right, with the I-D mod equivalence relation, then you have this equality. And we've discussed how the G sub Fs actually separate out the distinguished nilpotent orbits, so this isn't that hard to swallow. Okay. So now let's discuss, now we have a dual basis, so now let's discuss how to get an excellent basis for the restriction to the Lie algebra version of the Ewald-Hoyer-Heck algebra of the distributions supported on the compact elements. Right, and this word excellent, it's only being used in this lecture. Okay, so the first remark, as I said before, this is hard in general. But for the QTGs, QTGFs, it's doable. It's actually easy. So we'll take a look at that. Okay, so choose absolutely any XT in GF such that the centralizer in the group over the finite field of the image of XT in LF is T. Okay? So let's fix a pair F, Q, T, G sub F. Okay, you choose absolutely any element of the Lie algebra that has the property that when you pop it down over the finite field, its centralizer in here is T. So note that nu sub xt is a compact, is an element, it's certainly an invariant distribution, and since xt is in LF, or is in GF, sorry, it's certainly supported. So we have the following theorem, which, it'll appear online anyway. As above. Okay, so before I write it down, why would you even consider doing such a thing? You would consider doing such a thing because of Kajian's result, right? Because this thing is related to that thing. So for xt as above, and any f prime g in ig, we have that the orbital integral mu sub xt of g hat, so the orbital integral of xt evaluated at the Fourier transform of g sub f prime is 0 when f prime g is not equivalent to f rtg, qtg. And it's equal to some very nice number, which is independent of xt and non-zero, some nice non-zero number. otherwise. And this number, you know, involves things that looks essentially like this, but then you have to involve things I can't discuss because we don't know enough quite yet, but we will in a few minutes. So this is really cool. Oh, one thing I forgot to tell you, right, is that this function here, it lives in here. So it's a good kind of function. It lives exactly where it should, where the sum is over all chambers in the building. Why is this a cool result? So remember, on the very first lecture, so long ago, we presented as an example of an application of how to use a pre-homogeneity result. We presented this result of Harishchandra that said that the Fourier transforms of regular semi-simple orbital integrals are locally constant in some sense. But here, what does this say? So these things from the lemma which you believed form a basis, right? A dual basis to the restriction to the Lie algebra version of the Ewald-Heck algebra of the JG0. Well, we're getting zero or some number that's completely independent of XT. Okay, so what does that say about this thing? It says that this thing is completely, says that the restriction to functions which are locally constant and compactly supported on G0 plus the set of topologically nilpotent elements of the Fourier transform of this guy is completely, or just say, is independent of the choice of XT. Okay? So you get this extreme local constancy for this guy, which is pretty cool. So why are these distributions mu sub XT potentially excellent? Right. After all, part of being excellent is that you have to be able to manage these things in a very nice way. And so that's what we're going to close with, is why you should believe that this is a good thing to do. So remember, the goal is to you have these things now, and now what you want to do is you want to form stable distributions and things that are obviously non-stable so that you can describe stable and non-stable things on the nilpotent set. Okay. So how do you control these? So I think we're up to D. Whoops, I spelled the whole thing. I hope that's how I spell it in Karen. Well, it turns out that there's a very pretty theory here. So a torus T and G, or sometimes I'll just take T, which is the group of K rational points of that thing, is called unramified, provided that it splits over an unramified extension. So here's some examples. RA is such a thing because it's already split. And in SL2, you can write some down with P02. You have that the set of matrices of the form A, B, B, epsilon, A, such that epsilon is a unit but not a square. And of course, a squared minus epsilon b squared equals 1. This is an unramified torus splitting over the splitting over the quadratic and ramified extension is unramified. And if you if you were to replace this matrix with a B var pi inverse B epsilon var pi A here, and then have the same condition, then that also would be an unramified torus. Okay? And in fact, up to conjugation in SL2, these are the three unramified torus. Okay? So just to be completely clear, there are other kinds of tori in SL2, and the other guys look something like this, A, B, B, var pi, A, such that A squared minus B var pi, B squared var pi is 1. This thing is we usually call it a ramified torus. And depending on whether minus 1 is a square or not, there will either be 2 or 4 conjugate classes of ramified tori. Here's the thing. We want to parameterize these things, and they look a lot like things that should live over the finite field. And so, just like we did for nilpotent orbits, we turn to the finite field situation. So, what happens over the finite field? So, over the finite field, SL2 has two conjugacy classes as maximal F tori. One, of course, is the split guy, and then one is anisotropic. It is anisotropic, but let's use the word minisotropic. Right? And if you want the split guy looks just like it should, and then if P is not 2, then the other guy looks just like this, where here you replace the R's with F's. And how about GL1? Well, GL1 has one conjugacy class, of course, of F anisotropic tori. Sorry, minisotropic tori. Because after all, it's abelian, it's a torus, so it's itself. So you put this together. So what do you have? You have a picture like this. There's the fundamental alcove, and then we take its closure for the action of SL2 on its building. Remember, here we have SL2 as the group over the finite field, and here we have GL1. So how many anisotropic tori are here? There's exactly one. 1 plus 1 plus 1 is 3, and 3 is the number of unramified tori in SL2, because you have the split guy, and then this guy, and that guy. So, just as before, you have a theorem saying that this is always true. Before we state the theorem, we have a definition. So IM, so now we have an ID, an IG, and an IM. I for indexing. So in our setup, since we don't have the full building, I guess I have to put something like this. So what is this? F a facet as usual. And this notation means the conjugacy class of a minisotropic torus. Okay, and as before, you have the natural equivalence relation, right? So then you have the theorem, lemma, whatever. If you look at IM and you mod out by this equivalence relation, then you have a bijective correspondence with conjugacy classes of maximal unramified So let's do some examples. We've already seen SL2. So let's do SL2 again. So it turns out that over a finite field, the conjugacy classes of F min isotropic toy are parameterized exactly by the non-parabolic conjugacy classes in the viral group. Okay? This is because over a finite field, conjugacy classes of tori are in one-to-one correspondence with conjugacy classes in the viral group. You can look in Carter's book to see that. And then if you want only those that are min isotropic, then the appropriate thing to take over here are those elements which do not intersect the proper parabolic subgroup of the viral group. So in SL2, the viral group has two elements, the trivial one and the one that Carter labels A1. And so you get a picture like this. We already know that there's three, so there you go. For SL3, three conjugacy classes. So the one for the Coxeter element is labeled A2. These three edges are all equivalent. They only give you one guy. Here you have one. And indeed, SL3 has exactly, five unramified toi at the conjugation. And then you can do SP4, where life gets a little interesting. So inside of here, you have two non-parabolic conjugacy classes, which Carter labels C2 and A1 cross A1 twiddle. So this is the long element sending roots to their opposites. Here you have A1 twiddle, A1 twiddle. A1. Here again, this is an SP4, so you have C2 and A1 cross A1 twiddle. And then here you just have A1 cross A1 twiddle. Okay? So what was the point of all this? The point of this is that we want to be able to control which combinations are going to end up being stable and which ones are going to end up not being stable. And this, in fact, allows us to do that. Oh, right. So I forgot to tell you how this map works. So you take this guy here on this side, and what do you want to map it to? Well, I mean, if you go over the maximal unramified extension, then this thing is a split torus. And so you can just, I mean, there's going to be a torus over the base field that you can identify with it, essentially schematically. And so that's the torus you put here. Or if you don't like that, you can just think that you're really just lifting the damn thing out. Okay. You think Hensel's limit or something. Okay, so now, why does this make it golden? Why are we good? What do I want to say? How's this help? Okay, so we have this element, F, Q, T, G sub F. Right? It's our dual base, this guy. And I just erased the thing that said that that this orbital integral was exactly the guy that picked this guy off nicely as in part of the dual basis. So you just associate to this thing, you just strip it of everything but the T. Okay? And then from Carter's thing, you associate this to some element of the viral group for the group over F. And then you lift, actually not element, but conjugacy class. Right? Because the conjugacy classes conjugacy classes in the viral group parameterize the conjugacy classes of maximal tori. Then you flip that thing up into the affine viral group. So you get some elements. Well, actually, you can just take the conjugacy class and what we're calling W tilde, and then you squish that back down into the viral group. And so then you have a map from there to there. Okay? But that's just the normalizer in G of A mod A. And it turns out, because remember, we have an enormous degree of freedom on these X sub T's, right? It turns out that you can choose things. It turns out that the only way these can be stably conjugate, if you have UXT and UXT prime, say, is if the image here is the same. Okay? So if you have another one, F prime Q B prime G F prime, then the only hope then UXT can be stably XT, say, stably conjugate to XT prime, if and only if they have the same image over here. Okie doke. So what does that mean? So for SL2, that means, for example, that you're going to have, at least if you only consider the mu sub XTs, you're going to have two stable guys, this one plus this one, because the A1s, you lift them into the affine viral group, you squish it back down, you're looking at A1 conjugacy class in the viral group. Here you're going to have this one plus this one, so you'll have three. Of course, remember, we're not considering the full set, we're just considering the things that come from the nice green functions coming from the linguistic characters. And then for SP4, I forgot the one, you're going to have, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah. And so, in fact, in this way, using the homogeneity results, you can go about finding extremely nice bases with which to figure out what things are stable and which things might not be stable. So that's the idea of asterisk 269. Then you have to go another 400 pages, and you're finished. Okay.